I'm Carlos Virgen, and this is The Storyline, produced by The Day in New London, Connecticut. As part of our ongoing series of conversations with local artists of color, poet and educator Jose B. Gonzalez talked to Rick Koster about immigration, poetry, education, and what it means to not see an accurate representation of yourself in popular culture.
I think it was in 2017, you published a collection of poetry called One Love Was Reels, R-E-E-L-S. And the early part of the book, the first section of the book, associated movies you remember from growing up in El Salvador under the care of your grandmother. And it's sort of an imprinting. You remember those movies and it reminds you of the times with your grandmother before you came to the States. The second part of the book associates films with after you arrived in New York City. And it struck me how poetry is a visual, a sort of a quick hit visual artistic discipline anyway. What attracted you to poetry in that context? And I think of it because film is so visual. So you're drawing these incredible portraits. What was it about poetry that resonated with you and made you pursue that in terms of possibly another artistic medium?
Well, I think that with poetry, you get to speak a little bit more, a lot more metaphorically, right? And you get to experiment a little bit more with language. And poetry also, I think, is a medium that lets you portray emotions in a more powerful way. And so whether it's that collection or my first collection, Toys Made of Rock, what I'm trying to do is trying to bring the reader through a journey of emotions, right? This emotional truth, so to speak. And now sometimes that emotional truth isn't necessarily the same as a literal truth, right? That's why we have metaphor. So we try to, a lot of times when we write as poets, you know, we try to use images that can help us interpret for the reader and help the reader get a better sense of what we're talking about. So film for me was always an incredible journey, right? Because rarely did I ever see myself in film here in the U.S. In El Salvador, that was fairly easy. But in the U.S., you know, here's a kid who was never a gangster, right? We made pretend we used to live in New London. When I lived in New London with my homeboys, as we called them, right? They, we were so geeky that at one point we actually bought a book on how to break dance, right? And we were behind Mr. G's, and a tough guy walked by and we kind of kicked the book under, right? And said, you know, get rid of this thing. You know, we still need street credits, the few that we have. But you know, some of those films, they were, you know, even at a younger age when I saw these figures portrayed as gangsters, portrayed as criminals, I thought, man, brown skin doesn't equate to that, right? That's the film truth, right? That's the version that most people see. And so through poetry, I want really readers to understand what that feels like to watch, at least in that second book, to watch a film where I see this false representation, right? And you know, as we think about today, I think that that's partly what's going on is as we look at you know, why people form their opinions about race, a lot of it is based on film because it's certainly not based on what we've read, right? We're outside that curriculum. So,
yeah, and I think it's interesting that film or television do so much form images and impressions like that. If I grew up reading Gabriel Marquez heavily Pablo Neruda, and I grew up in Texas, and I had a very romantic and lush visual idea of life south of the border, if you'll forgive me my Texas-ness for
sure.
That's what it meant. It meant to me. I didn't. And I guess I suppose you could see that across the spectrum of film. It's a popular thing. You're watching The Godfather or NCIS New Orleans or whatever, the bad guy, good guy thing. But
right.
Let's move in that context. So I you write beautifully, is what I say. I associate it with that sort of almost a magical realism sort of visual imagery. You came to the United States and you have been through the immigration process. Try to reconcile that with what has happened in the last 4 years since we've had a new president. How are you moved as an artist in that context? Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. You know, when we look at the history of the way that immigrant children have been treated, there you go again in terms of the way that history sometimes misrepresents and the way that oftentimes people who don't have a solid understanding of that migration pattern, they don't quite get the reality, right? And so, you know, children along the border and coming to the U.S. along the border, I mean, that's nothing new, right? But the fact is that policies during this last administration have made it more difficult, have created these horrible conditions that have resulted in family separations, right? And that's a fact. That's not an opinion. And so for me, as an artist, but first as a human being, to see some of that is just really, really painful. In part, you know, in my case, my parents came here first. My father came here to the U.S. and picked New London, right, of all places, right? You know, days like this, it's perfect. But in the winter, I think, why New London? Yeah. And so I didn't see him for part of my life. My mother one day said to me, well, I'm going to go join your father. And I'm thinking, okay, we won't see you for a few weeks. And then she said, no, I don't know when I'll see you. And that's the time we stayed with our grandmother. And that was really difficult, right, to have that separation. And you think about the way that children's minds are shaped, right? I mean, I know they say that their minds continue to be shaped up until they're 21. And, you know, when I think of my teenage girls, I have to really think about that over and over again. Right. But the fact is that, you know, at that age, it is traumatic. Right. And that's a word that we hear a lot, that trauma. Right. But it is, it's absolutely traumatic to have that kind of separation. Right. And when we were reunited here in the U.S., on Federal Street, things were lovely, but they weren't the same. My father, who had left behind this young little boy, got a slightly older version of that, right? And then didn't really have those years where, you know, that little, you know, that bonding, I think, was absent, right? It was kind of stolen, right? And so, you know, there's a price to pay, and that's on a real small scale. Never mind being away from from parents, from a mother, a father, to have the legal system throw you in there and treat you really not just like as a criminal, but as an adult, right? I mean, I've seen cases of little kids, children who had to put an X, right? Were forced to take oaths, right? As children with no real adult support. And you know, we're a nation that can, you know, we can be strict, right? We can be strict, but we don't have to be heartless. We don't have to be heartless. And that's really what's taken place in the last few years. It's that heartless. We've forgotten that. We've forgotten that that empathy is part of the American tradition. It's pretty sad.
Yeah. How has that affected you as a writer? Did it not just in terms of the sheer emotional or even the politics of it, but did it inspire this great burst of creativity? Is it something that requires a lot of thought or, yeah, talk about that.
No, absolutely. You know, and I think that there's, again, when we talk about price, right, there are prices to pay, right? So, you know, I heard, for example, Rhonda Ward's powerful poem, right? Which wow, you know, you listen to her voice and you hear that history, you hear that emotion, right? You know her family, you know so much more, right? But let's face it, right? It came at a price. It cost her quite a bit to write that, right? Emotionally. I mean, that had to have been draining. And I have felt that way as I've written more stories or, you know, more poems about myself, about growing up. And in some cases, I've tried actually to get away from talking about or writing about immigration, right? Because I think my pen could take it, but really my heart can't, right? And I mean that. I mean, I there are times when I find myself just driving alone and think about something I write, and you know, I get teary-eyed, right? And some people say, well, you kind of need that as a poet, right? That you really have to become the poet, and that you, the poem rather, and that you have to put yourself all in, right? But putting yourself all in is different when you're talking about something so distant. But when you're talking about immigration and particularly children, right, which is a recurring theme in my work, right? I'm working on a third collection where I'm looking at the literary canon and looking at you know, what that has meant for me as a writer, as a student, as an immigrant, as a professor of English. And as I've gone through and written these poems, I've had to take breaks. I have. And so, you know, on the one hand, you know, you feel like there is a creative juice that somehow needs to somehow be acknowledged, right, and incorporated and filled, right, fill a cup, right, with it. But at the same time, it's I think for any writer of color who's writing about whether it's immigration or race, especially in the last few years, especially now, I really don't know how an African American writer could be writing about Mr. Floyd right now without giving so much of their soul, giving so much of themselves, you know. And again, in the last few years, I have been inspired, but again, it has come at a price.
As a teacher, can you quantify, can you see the difference in your students over the against the backdrop of things happening over the past few years, as opposed to, I mean, things are always happening in the world, but we went through a period of relative normalcy, if you want to call it, for a few years, and then the last few have been pretty tough. Can you tell in your students that there is a perception that results in an increased appetite for the arts and the answers that they might get or through the English that you teach? Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, I mean, there are students, right, who are young, right? And so we always have to take that into account anytime we're teaching, that if they come in with certain opinions, whether they agree with me or whether they have the opposite opinions, that they're still minds that still need to be, you know, they're still in the process of learning, right? And so in the last few years, what I have found is that in terms of their opinions on some of these matters who are coming into the classroom, I don't necessarily think that they've been that different. The difference, however, has been how vocal they have been, right? So a case in point, in one class, we were going over a story, Sonny's Blues, I believe it was, by James Baldwin. And in that story, this individual struggles with moving forward in his life. And I won't say too much because I'm the kind who doesn't like to give too much away, but he lives in the projects, right, at first, or lives in Harlem, right, and then just has a difficult time getting through that. And I remember a student saying, and again, this was a couple of years ago, saying, well, the poor get everything, right? Something to that effect, right? And on the one hand, I'm glad that he's saying it because I don't want him to just think it and not open it up for discussion, right? But it froze me. Quite frankly, it froze me. And I thought, wow, how do I go back and kind of and address this in a way where it's not top down, where I come back and say you're wrong or anything, you know, because I don't want to create chill in the classroom. I want these discussions to take place. And then, you know, I'm thinking at home, what can I say? What could I have said? I mean, just replaying it over and over again. I'm reminded of the Seinfeld episode where George Costanza said something about shrimp, right? So there's, I don't know if you've ever seen it. But anyway, so then, you know, I'm thinking it's going to come up. It's going to come, you know, maybe next time it comes up. And sure enough, it came back again the next class. And he said it again, almost word for word. And that's when I addressed it by asking him, well, I grew up poor, right? And I gave them a little bit of my history and told them about how my father, for example, he used to walk the streets of El Salvador and used to be one of these children who sold, in his case, soap on the streets of El Salvador. You know, sometimes you travel to other countries and you see children working in the streets, and that was my father. And so, you know, I mentioned some of that history, and then in the end I said, so what do you think someone like me got, right? What is it? What was it? And I think that it took that story for him to really reflect on that language, right? That the poor get everything, right? And I don't think that necessarily changed his mind entirely, but I think it opened up, you know, a door that maybe hadn't been opened before. And so, you know, I think of rhetoric and I think of the art of persuasion and how, you know, sometimes we want to address the individual and we want to address the comment, but at the same time, we also have to take into account, you know, where they got their information from, right? And what makes them feel that way. And you know, my guess is that's someone who had been, you know, that victim of education, who hadn't read many of these stories, who hadn't thought of all these other possibilities. And so, and that's where education, I think, is so crucial. You know, the state of Connecticut, by the way, passed legislation that would require that Latino and African American studies, right, would be part of the curriculum in schools, right, and which is really exciting. But again, we fail because we don't have experts working on this, right? And so sometimes, you know, even sound efforts, you know, they don't do such a great job. And so by the time they get to us in college, you know, they will have missed out on all sorts of opportunities to read diverse works.
I subscribe to the publisher's marketplace and a couple of professional writing things. And the sales on books about race relations by authors of color across poetry, whatever, are just rising exponentially in the wake of the last 2 weeks. So I guess that's a good thing to come out of this. You've been off because of the COVID-19, at least out of the classroom. Would you change your curriculum at all to reflect some of the things that have happened if you guys start up again in September?
Absolutely. I mean, we would have to. In my case, not for nothing, but I had incorporated a lot of what we had, some of what's going on now, not to this extent, but I thought I had done a pretty, comprehensive job of including authors who would address some of these issues. Mike, and not to play the pessimist there, but I do get a little bit concerned when, I'm encouraged at the same time that I'm cautiously optimistic in that, that boom in literature, I think is a great sign. At the same time, I worry that, what we're looking for are temporary cures and not long-term fixes, right? So if we're all incorporating these readings next semester, that doesn't quite change the curriculum, right? It changes a semester experience. And what we need is so much more than that, right? And that's why I was saying that about the curriculum here in Connecticut, that legislature has made a commitment to change. But what does that mean, right? Does it mean that we'll have certain books taught forever, right? Or however long that is? Or is this a trend, right? And what I'm hoping is that, after this bump in sales, that it'll continue. And as an author who has been invited to readings, I reflect on that. And I think all over the country, I think, okay, well, who invited me and where, when was I included, right? And a lot of times, that party that I've been invited to is because it had, a Latino flavor, right? It had some Latino music in the background, right? And that's not, which I'm entirely grateful for, entirely grateful. But that, when we look at, well, what about all these other parties? Why not, to a party that includes everyone, right? That's where I think, I get a little concerned and I am having the same reaction. I think that other writers of color, I've spoken to other folks who are getting all these invitations from, places that had ignored their work before. And again, it's great that they're invited. It's great that they're in the limelight. But that light better last a long time, right? Because otherwise, we've been here before. And, that walk, that march, it doesn't end in one day, right? It's a march that lasts for a few years. And so, it's a matter of, again, is the glass half full or half empty? I think our youth are doing a great job, and I'm hoping that they'll keep that pressure up and they'll continue. They know how to get things done, right? Hopefully it'll result in something more long-term.
I am encouraged by those sales, but I wonder how many copies of Ralph Ellison and James Baldwin are going to sit on someone's bookshelf like, well, yeah, we bought it and I need to get around to reading it. And 5 years from now, I'll still be sitting on the bookshelf.
Yeah, well,
I hope not.
I wrote letter to the editor in the day, right, about Ann Petrie's The Street, right? Here's an African-American author who sold, you know, she was the first African-American to sell over 1 million copies of her book, right? Over right. 1 million, right? And ask around, do people know her? Do we have anything recognizing her? Do we have an acknowledgement that this major literary figure was in our backyard? You know, if we use her as an example, right? This is what happens when we take our eyes off the steering wheel, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Jose, you got any thoughts that you want to share?
You know, just I think that in terms of language, that, you know, poets concentrate on language, right? That's our specialty, right? And so the language that we use has to continue to evolve in a way that recognizes inequities, right? The term Black Lives Matter, right, now has a new meaning because of someone's death, right? And the fact that more people are using that term offers hope that possibly other terms that at one time may have been considered offensive to some and that may have been considered reasons to oppose certain human rights movements, that maybe, just possibly, if Black Lives Matter, if those words can mean something which they intended to mean in the first place to everyone, then yeah, there's some hope, right? So, you know, that language does matter.